Welcome to the Upland Nation podcast. I'm your host, Scott Linden, also host of the television show Wing Shooting USA. Exciting podcast in store for you and me as well today. We're on location at the Grand Seal Lodge in Plankinton, South Dakota. And some very exciting things on the docket for this podcast. Your calls. Yeah, we're going to be discussing the challenges we face keeping our sport alive and relevant. Our world record holder and good friend Dave Miller from CZ USA will be here to talk about how you set another shotgunning world record and how that is relevant to you and me as just plain old shotgun hunters. We'll talk about public access. We'll cover some hunting strategy and dog handling tips and a quiz, trivia question, and a prize. It's all coming up right here on the Upland Nation podcast. Don't go away. And thank you to Sage and Breaker Mercantile. You can learn more about them at sageandbreaker.com. Heirloom quality gun care and gun cleaning products. You know, I hate to say it, but it's almost Christmas. If you want to get in on the newest gear from Sage and Breaker, get on the mailing list, sageandbreaker.com. And welcome ESPAmerica.com. These hearing protection devices are nano-coated against moisture, whether it's a sweaty ear or the rain coming down on your next South Dakota bird hunt. All right. So very exciting and very honored to have our guest today. So let's go on into the next room where we've got another setup going and talk shotgunning world records. All right, we are at the Grand Seal Lodge near Plankinton, South Dakota, where we had an incredible CZ USA Next Gen Youth Hunt yesterday. Joining me today, CZ USA's shotgun manager, expert shooter, gun designer, trick shooter, and we're going to start with your most recent accomplishments, David Miller. Tell me what you did a week or so ago and why.
Well, myself and Team CZ USA, I say Team CZ USA, I'm talking about four youth shooters from the Scholastic Clay Target Program and AIM program shot for a new Guinness World Record for the most clay targets shot and broken in 12 hours by a team of five.
12 hours is a long time for anybody to shoot, but a bunch of kids who probably not shot for any length of time at all. How did you prepare for something like that, Dave?
Well, you know what? I don't know if you can get prepared for something like that, but what we had done, I spent a lot of time doing the math, you know, breaking down the day. The 12 hours consists of 720 minutes, and then we broke that down by 480-minute quadrants. And then we took that and broke that down by 4 45-minute quadrants, and we only shot 35 minutes, took 10 minutes off, 35 minutes, 10 minutes off, and that was our day. That was our day. And so we had a couple other plans. It was like plan A, which is the aggressive plan, which is what I just described, all the way from just shooting 30 minutes and taking 15 minutes off, which we did at one segment just because we'd already set the record. We just kind of took a break. But, you know, in preparation before that, the kids had to qualify at a world record qualifier event held at each national championship, the AIM Grand, which is at Sparta, Illinois, at the World Shooting Complex. But before that was the SCTP, Scholastic Clay Target Program Nationals, that was held at the Cardinal Center in Marengo, Ohio. So that was a 50-target qualifier. The kids could shoot it as many times as they want in preparation for this. And we were taking top scores. And then after that, they had to write an essay. This is the best part. They had to write an essay explaining to the marketing team of CZ USA why they deserve to be on a world record team and what youth shooting sports programs had meant to them. Fascinating what they say.
Well, I can't wait to get into that, but number one, congratulations. So what caused you to think about even trying to set a new world record in a field that it's full of people trying to break records and break targets?
Yeah, and that's just what you said. You can go to a tournament. The kids can go to a tournament. Adults can go to tournaments. And it's all about how many targets you broke and what classification you're in. And everybody shoots with similar skill set. But these are kids from all over the board. And you did have to be a pretty good shot. I mean, all these kids had a list of accolades as long as their arm. However, they also showed great character in their essays. So we were looking for, we had some great scores. The essays weren't so good. So they didn't get selected. So these kids came out of the woodwork and wrote, I mean, some of them will just literally make you cry, some of the stories that they've had and how the shooting sports programs has changed their lives and created a new outlook for this young individual and give them something to do. You know, you may not be good at football or basketball or volleyball or baseball or whatever, but boy, you can shoot a shotgun. You know, that's what we were after. We want to find these young adults that have been impacted by, in a positive way, the clay target shooting sports. So,
you know, I remember back in the day, I still joke about it, if it hadn't been for a certain Boy Scout program or leader in, you know, one of the sports I played, I'd be doing hard time somewhere. I mean, tell me a little bit about some of the stories and how shooting sports changed their lives.
Well, it gave several of them a direction. There was one or two of them particularly, that seemed a little bit lost in life. And when her father introduced her to this, she just took off with it. And the next thing you know, this is all she wants to do. She didn't feel like she fit in with things because she wasn't able to play sports. And now, you know, she's on top of the world and literally holds a Guinness World Record. So, you know, you can go and win a tournament, and that's for a minute, and you have this trophy or whatever. Then that tournament happens again next year, and you got to compete in it again. But a Guinness World Record doesn't happen very often. So these four kids, young adults, I mean, two of them are 19, one was 17, one was 16, and the girls were the youngest ones. They have that certificate. Probably is going to stand for a long time because we broke a bunch of targets.
Tell me a little bit about the record-setting attempt itself. What was the former world record, and why would you want to try something like this, Dave?
Well, two reasons. We want to elevate youth shooting. We want to give back to those programs that have been good to us. We have great relationships with both the AIM program and SCTP. From the perspective of, we sponsor their national championship and their events, and they give us lots of love. They allow us the awesome platform of being able to showcase our product to thousands of kids and families. I'm trying to create CZUSA as a household brand. Like, I grew up with a Winchester and Remington, and you know, the list goes on of gun makers that have been around a long time. Well, these kids are new, you know. They think CZ as a Remington or a Winchester, you know, so that's pretty awesome. So, you know, it's the idea behind it was to give them something new to strive for, and we launched a new semi-automatic in the process. But, you know, that was the goal. But really, at the end, it was about these kids, not so much about that product.
How do you think those kids came in? You know, we talked with Ben yesterday about his first pheasant hunt, but these kids came in with expectations. They'd earned their way onto the team. They knew it was going to be an arduous physical task. How did they cope with all of that? What did you see coming out in their character?
You know, they all stayed very positive. You know, they had a lot of eyeballs on them. They were not going to let me or each other down. I can tell that one or two times I looked over to my left and it looked like that shotgun weighed about 35 pounds as she was trying to pick it up, you know, but she kept on going, and you know, they all did an amazing job. It was outstanding. I mean, we shot 20,425 shotgun shells. Okay, we were loading five, shooting at four targets that were thrown two following pairs. So it was two up, and then right behind that, two more. So we had five rounds in the gun, could shoot at four targets. We threw 17,250 clay targets out of 10 fabulous mech clay target throwers. And of those 17,250 targets, we hit 14,167. So that was about an 82% or a little over an 82% average of targets thrown. And that was 9 hours of shooting spread out over that 12-hour period.
What was the former record, and how does everybody's shoulder feel? Or, and you may have a better answer for this, but what was the previous record?
The previous record was 4,602. Okay, keep in mind we hit 14,167, so more than triple the old record. This was held by some guys in Great Britain. They established that in 2005.
So on your right arm, there's a number. On your left arm, will there soon be another number? You're going to need another arm for this one.
Yeah, so I do have a tattoo from my first world record on my right arm for the most in 1 hour by one person, me. And everybody says, what's the next tattoo? I get that question a lot. I don't know. I don't know if I can endure the pain of the from the first one again. So maybe a little bitty one. I don't know, like the size of a dime. I don't know. This one's the size of a baseball, and it hurt. So I don't know. I don't have a logo for it. I don't know what it is yet. I didn't know what this was going to be until a year later. So we'll see. Maybe it'll come out.
It looked painful, and it was fresh when I first saw it. I can't imagine. Let's see. It'd be at least three more, a couple more digits in there, plus the whatever goes around it. Dave, is there anything in this whole record-setting career of yours that is applicable to us schmoes out in the bird field? I mean, what have you learned over the years in shooting that many targets that we might apply when we're out chasing a quail or something?
Well, I had a question the other day. What is the most important thing that you can work on as a wing shooter or a clay shooter? And this applies to the day we were setting that record to the day we're just, I'm just shooting a little bit of five stand training, you know, or I'm going to go out and do a dove hunt or a bird hunt. The biggest thing a person can work on is learning how to mount the shotgun smoothly. If you have a good mount and you can bring that gun to your face, not your face to the gun to the face, and it shoot where you look, you're going to hit more birds. You're going to break more targets. I promise you.
Yeah, that's easier said than done. And I know we were drilling on that a little bit yesterday with our young shooter. Does that mean more work by the left hand, more work by the right hand? Is it all in the head, in the brain? Or you know, it's easy to say. Is there something we can do?
You know what? A video camera doesn't lie. So I video a lot of people on their mount. It should be one fluid motion to the face. It's not barrel down, stock up, barrel back up, stock up, you know, a seesaw of mount of the shotgun. It should be fluid to the face. The barrel should come up level or pivot at the muzzle and come in smooth. So when you video yourself in on a shot, because your intention's on the clay, but you, if I was to video you, Scott, and you saw yourself mount the gun, you'd be like, wow, I didn't know I was doing that. You bet, because you're all your attention's on the clay target. You don't feel it. You don't know it. But until you see yourself on that cell phone camera going, making that move, or seeing that gun snag on your shirt as you bring it to your face, then you know what you got to correct. So video cameras, they don't lie. I use them a lot.
I learned to teach from a teacher who taught with video back in the day when it was still on those big clunky machines, and it's absolutely true. So when you're watching us mount a gun, take me through the motion, because this is one of the things I try to stress as well. Where is the dog goes on point. Everybody's safe. Everybody's in a line. I'm the shooter, but I'm also going to fly the bird. Take over.
Okay. So when I walk in, a lot of times, depending on the wind, I know the bird's going to fly into the wind just enough to get some pheasant for sure, get lift. So they want to go into the wind and then they peel out 9 out of 10 times. So I'm prepared. Like yesterday, the wind was blowing pretty good. So we take a few steps in, that bird pops up and then hooks to the wind. Well, I know I'm going to make that pivot. And I'm going to pivot off of my lead foot being my left foot because I'm a right-handed shooter. I'm going to swing my right heel around and give myself plenty of time give myself an open stance to be able then to mount the gun. Not mount the gun pivot, it's move your body, mount the gun to the lead side of the bird. So, and that mount needs to be smooth and deliberate, but you first got to get your rear end spun around so you can mount the gun right.
You know, you do enough of this with, and in fact, I will promise you, I'm going to put a stopwatch to some of this stuff when we go back and start reviewing the raw tape, because we all seem to think we need to shoot the moment the bird gets off the ground. We don't have the luxury of 15 seconds, but we have more time than we think, don't we, Dave?
Absolutely. There's lots of time. I mean, these pheasants are big, the quail are big, are fast, and you know, but you still have to have time. You still owe it to the bird to take time to get set up to make a good shot. That's most important. And you owe it to your dog and yourself. You know, you want to get a good hit, so it's an ethical harvest, and it gives the dog an opportunity to make a good retrieve for you instead of chasing down a pheasant that'll run 100 yards in 2 seconds.
You know, I'm intrigued with what you just described it, because you do owe it to the bird, and we've talked in the past about how you give it another beat or two, and the pattern opens up to the point where you actually might have a chance at hitting a bird going away from your crossing in front of you. Is that part of it?
That's absolutely part of it. I've seen too many guys shoot big shells, great big magnum loads on birds that are 35 feet off the end of their gun, and then that thing's not worth eating, or they just miss it altogether. And more than likely, they miss it altogether, and then maybe they get a second shot, maybe then their buddy shoots it. But overall, everything was just rushed. Just relax, take a step, mount the gun smoothly on the lead side of the bird, and you will kill more pheasants.
In fly fishing, we used to tell everybody to not set the hook until the old school British guys would say, "God save the Queen," and then they'd lift up on the rod. We need to come up with one of those, but we do need to wait a little bit. Now let's go back to approaching the bird, approaching the dog. Where is the gun on your body?
My gun gets out in front. I put the heel of the gun literally on my zipper, so it's out there. Because I want to go straight up, not out from under my armpit and out forward, then up. I'm right on my zipper. My gun's at a 45-degree angle to the ground. And sometimes I don't even take one step in front of the other. I do like a stutter step, keeping my left leg in front. So I'm always ready, and my left leg is planted firmly on the ground fast, so I can then swing my right heel around to make the adjustments and shoot the bird. Which, doing all those things, allows you to have a nice, smooth, slow mount and get that right, rather than to rush the stance and then feel like you got to rush the mount and then totally rush the shot. I'd rather be smooth and deliberate and let that bird fly 8 more feet, 20 more feet, and make a good shot on the bird, rather than to do it really fast.
Any tricks on helping us slow down that gun mount? I mean, this is really the bugaboo in this whole game is, no matter how long we wait, however we set our feet, we still want to just throw that thing up and pull the trigger. Mm-hmm. Instead of "God save the Queen," what should we be saying?
So what I do, I teach a lot of wing shooters to learn how to shoot. And I set up clay target throwers at a high angle, you know, maybe a 45-degree angle, because we're trying to demonstrate, especially young shooters, that there just needs to be some blue sky between the ground and the bird. And get that target up and throw it slow, because clay targets come off machines fast and slow down, where a bird coming out of the grass comes out slow and takes off and gets gain speed. So face the opposite direction, or 90 degrees out, throw the target, take time, make a step, then mount the gun and shoot the bird, shoot the clay target. So you work on that. But you also, you want to work on timing. So another person who's pushing the button can also run a stopwatch. So once the clay pushes out of the grass, you can actually time the person's move, mount, and shoot and see how fast they are. Even on a clay target, people move too quick. They think they're out of time. It should take, you know, 3 seconds, 4 seconds. You know, you got all kinds of time. So 3 seconds, you know, and they'll do it in 1.5. Super fast. So it's just no different than timing an American trap shooter on a field from whenever they close the gun and call pull, and then they fire the gun. Youth shooters typically get faster. Adults do it as well. Youth always do. They outrun their own mind and trigger finger, and it causes a miss. Keeping people on track with a stopwatch allows them to stay on track, and it trains you to be consistent.
When I was taking lessons, and I should still take lessons if you have watched me, and you have, I remember being told to have that gun in what they call the ready position, which is that gun butt under the armpit, so that the movement is like this. You're telling me something different, and I'm not good enough to argue with that. And I'm thinking maybe I'll try that. But describe that. What are the steps in mounting the gun from that butt on the zipper position?
Well, it's directly underneath your eye. If you stand here like this, if you, of course, the listeners can't see me, but if I put my gun out in front, it's directly to my face here, rather than if it comes out from underneath your arm and you joust towards the gun, you still have the gun over here and your eye's on the inside. So the gun still has to come in. Well, that creates this with the barrel.
What he's describing is a pivot. Thank you. A right to left or a left to right pivot. Now, okay, I'm liking this. Tell me more.
So the gun just goes straight to the face, and it's one motion. It's two. It takes both hands, but the left lead hand or the hand on the forend guides the gun to the bird. And the right hand or left hand that brings that has the pistol grip, depending on your left or right handed, the hand that's holding the pistol grip brings the gun to the face. Okay.
And as you've said, we bring the gun up to the face, not the face down to the gun. Now, you talked about this with young Ben yesterday, but just describe the reason behind that, because it's geometry, isn't it?
Absolutely, it's math. You know, you have to bring the gun to the face. If you don't. And you try to get your head down to the gun, chances are you're not going to get your eye lined up with the rib, which is not lined up then with the bore of the shotgun. And guess what? You're not going to shoot where you're looking. There's a couple first birds. Here's his first hunt. He did amazing. He really got the hang of it after about the third or fourth one, where his head was up. He was referencing the target off the end of the barrel, but the barrel was coming up low and pointing high. So he shot over the birds. Guilty. Everybody does it. And experienced or new, it happens. A poor mount will cause you to shoot over the bird usually. So, but after that, we had a little talk. I was like, get your head in tight. Bring that gun in tight to your head. And I think right after that, he started just pounding birds. So it was good. Yeah. That way your eye matches the barrel. If not, your eye's a straight line of sight, but the gun coming in at an angle is still an angle.
You're listening to the Upland Nation podcast. I'm Scott Linden, your host. That's David Miller with CZ USA. CZ USA has really become a force. You know, I've shared some of the data from my viewers on how much stronger you guys have become over the years, and your innovation has taken yet another quantum leap, David. Some of the guns we were shooting yesterday were To a lot of people will be radical, but you have logic behind some of this stuff. I want you to describe some of the new stuff that you guys are coming out with.
So new for 2020, we have a whole series of guns, which is the ones you're speaking of. It's called the All Terrain Series. Probably the oddest one is to see a Bob White, which is a side by side 20 or 12 gauge shotgun, coated in an OD green ceramic coating. Okay, and that's ceramic coatings is stuff you see on tactical guns. You know, typically rifles or even a tactical gun or even a hunting rifle for inclement weather. Well, we're still hunting in the rain. I'm going to go hunt in the rain today. So I have a gun that's coated with a material that's going to protect it. It's green. I think it looks great. It's on a wood stock. But the coolest feature, well, it does have sling studs, so if you want to throw it over your shoulder, you can do that. And it's odd to see that on side-by-side. But the coolest thing, actually, I think, is the fact that the chambers are magnetic. So when you put two shells in that gun, you can open a gun, have a conversation with your buddy, pass the gun underneath a barbed wire fence like you had explained, you know, when you're by yourself and you slide it through the grass and the shells aren't going to fall out. The loaded shells aren't going to fall out into the snow or mud or grass and be gone. So it just retains them. You can literally turn the gun upside down with the chambers open, and the shells will stay in the gun. Think about it from sitting inside of a duck blind. And the duck blind is 2 feet in front of you, in front of your chest, and your barrel sticks up out of the duck blind. Well, typically, duck blind hunting or waterfowl hunting is usually done with pump guns or semi-automatics. For that only reason is the barrel's up. It's a straight gun. It's easy to load. I don't have to hinge it open to put shells in it. Well, in this case, those barrels can stay protruding out of the blind. I hinge the receiver down, stick two shells in up at a 45-degree angle out of the barrel sticking out of the barrel sticking out of the blind, and close the receiver behind the monoblock, behind the barrels. Bang, bang, open them up. They eject into the blind. I stick two more in. I'm good. So It's going to change the way we use over-unders and side-by-sides. And we have a whole series of these guns. There'll be 11 SKUs.
Okay, so all of that starts with magnets holding brass shells in the gun. Tell us something we don't know, Dave.
Well, what we don't know is 99.9% of the ammunition that's on the market is not brass. It's a brass wash, if it looks like brass. Some of them are just silver. It's metal. It's magnetic. There's only three manufacturers that I know of that still use brass hulls, and those are in their premium target loads primarily. So you're not really going to shoot target loads out of a duck blind. You're not going to shoot target loads on a pheasant field, maybe a quail field, but there's lots of options for steelhead casings.
And this doesn't change the engineering of the gun in any way. The patent is pending. You guys are already locking that up. It doesn't look any different unless you get up close and you take a look at where the magnets are. Describe that end of the transaction.
Yeah, most people are just like, I can't even see it because they're tiny, tiny magnets that are earth magnets that are inside the extractor or the ejectors. They're just placed in there. Yeah.
It functions just like every other gun out there, except it, to some of us, they just look cool. They act more practical for some of us. And the sling studs are an innovation that I think if that makes it a little bit simpler to use a sling, I think more people will try it and find the benefits. I've talked about that in the past. And the problem with most, especially if you're on the side-by-side, you got nowhere to put a sling except those slings that you cross your fingers and hope will stay on. What's been the reaction so far from folks like us yesterday when we saw those for the first time?
You know, most people say, well, that's pretty handy. Well, just for example, before I met you, we hunted a field north of here where we had to walk a quarter of a mile through down a little road that was too muddy to drive on before we got to the field that we were going to hunt. So I just slung the gun over my back. You know, that gave me two hands to, so that I can actually, you know, walk, you know, so it was easier. It's pretty handy. It's pretty handy. You know, it's not just for the duck hunters. Upland guys can use it too. And they just pop off. I mean, it's just a spring snap swivel thing that comes off. You don't want to carry it with you. You can take it off and put it in your vest pocket in the back.
You know, we've never talked about the fact that in Europe, it's commonplace. If you want a cool gun, you're gonna have a sling on it anyway. So now we're just coming full circle, aren't we?
Seems that way. I think it's very practical, and I think most guys and gals are going to enjoy having it on there.
You travel the country doing stuff like we did yesterday and shooting demonstrations, a lot of instruction, this motivating the kids thing, and that might be the most important aspect of what you do. Whether it's working with Ben yesterday or with your team of shooters that broke the world record, How do you get them motivated enough to either take up a gun and walk into a pheasant field in the rain, or know they're going to be shooting most of 12 hours? What's the motivator?
First, I think they have to have a mentor. You know, Ben has a mentor. His neighbor Bruce, kudos to him for bringing him here and getting him out here and getting him involved back home where they live in Florida. And so he's out there showing him. I have found that most youth shooters, hunters, have the gateway to the field. The gateway to the quail field, the pheasant field, has been now the clay target range. They go shoot, and then they think, well, maybe I want to go hunting. That was opposite for you and I, Scott. I started out sitting next to a fence post with my single-shot shotgun waiting for a dove to fly by. Then I thought maybe I would want to, later on, I want to go shoot clay targets. It's reversed, you know. The youth shooting sports programs are huge. We're invested in that. We spend a lot of time and energy helping people, helping kids, helping those programs, donating to them programs so that they have the tools they need to further this, which is all the reason why we did this Guinness World Record, which is the reason why we're at the championship events and spend the money and set up the demo stations. And, you know, it's a production. It's a 10-day thing. So We're completely invested in that, and I want to make sure that, once again, the CZUSA brand is a household name, that people understand what that is. You know, they grew up with it. They know what it is.
Louisville Slugger, if you were a little leaguer. Let's see. Custom Canadian Made, CCM, if you're a hockey player. And now CZ USA in the shotgun sports. If you were to leave us with one bit of advice about taking a kid hunting, what would you give us?
I would say make time to do it. Get out there and do it. Have a plan. Make sure that they have a good experience. Take them shooting clay targets first with a gun that's not going to kick them, a gun that's not very loud. I would try to make sure they have the safety equipment, eyes and ears, but it's baby steps. I see a lot of the teams, a lot of kids, they take the dads, the mentors, they go right out to an American trap field with an oscillating machine. They stand on the 16-yard line and let the kid try to shoot, and he hits 5 out of 25 by accident. Get right up next to the machine. Stand beside the clay target thrower and watch the clay come up. They got to break a few targets to get the bug. If they don't think they can do it right away, you may lose them. So they need to hit targets right away to get hooked on it. Make it easy. Make it easy.
You know, that brings up yet one more question, and thanks for sticking around. I know you're on the road yet again today. But do you think hunting is the logical next step if we're going to keep people in the sport? And what I mean by that is, yes, I agree. Shoot a clay target, some of the baggage, the psychological baggage of shooting a piece of asphalt out of the air is different than shooting a flying bird. Is it a way to retain kids into adulthood in the shooting sports to get them to the hunting portion of it?
I think so, absolutely. It is an easy gateway, and it's an easy way to get the kids out there. There's lots of places to go do it. There's lots of places to go shoot a trap target for sure across the country. So you got to start somewhere, and that you can do in August. You can do that in June. You can do that in whenever. Hunting season's a short little window. But you know, if you get them used to shooting a shotgun, the next step would be an upland bird hunt or a dove hunt or something like that, a duck hunt maybe. That way, you know, they already can segue from shooting clay, shooting a shotgun into clay's field to, you know, the upland field, the duck blind. I think that it's a lot easier to do that now, especially since a lot of the kids and youth shooters across the country or even youth programs are familiar with school programs that incorporate. You know, it's not just soccer and baseball anymore. It's clay targets. Yeah. So they know it's out there.
Growing fast. I'm not a golfer, but I'm thinking clay targets, driving range, hunting, golf course.
Yeah, great comparison. You're going to be able to hit the ball first before you can go play a round of golf. Perfect example.
Okay, now don't go away because we've got lots more, including your phone calls coming up from right here at Grand Seal Lodge near Plankinton, South Dakota. So stick around and listen to this commercial message from my friends at ESPAmerica.com. We're out today with one of our younger hunters and their mentor. They won the Next Gen contest that CZ USA was involved in, as was the Outdoor Mentors Program. Learn more about them at OutdoorMentors.com. But in addition to all of that, it struck me for, what I thought was a very interesting reason. Everybody in the field was wearing hearing protection. Yes, some of us were wearing some other brands, but I was wearing ESP America, and so were several others. And it worked. Just like it's supposed to, everybody heard the dog collar tags jingling, they heard the birds flushing, they heard us yelling directions from across the field. Yeah, you don't need to restrict your use of hearing protection to the range. If you're not already doing it, consider getting some hearing protection and using it in the field. You want to learn more? Go to ESPAmerica.com. This is our hand-lit segment, all about dog training and dog care. While I was out in the field today, something interesting happened. I ended up talking with a lot of folks about the Dogtra collars, the new Dogtra TNP Dual, but that's not what we're going to talk about yet. We're going to talk about all the other things you can do with a collar besides stimulate your dog. Most of them these days have all sorts of other capabilities. I'm using the vibrate component a lot in that collar. There's also a beep or a tone, depending on what kind of collar it is. And, you know, while we all use them for various purposes, I thought it'd be interesting to go back and think of some of the things that I've heard of or used them for in the past. Right now, I'm using that vibrate component, the function of vibrate, instead of stimulation in almost every case. Now, my dog understands what stimulation is all about, but instead of going to that level, most of the time I can approach the vibrate part of that whole reminder system in a way that works for Flick. Now, beepers, a lot of guys, especially in the grouse woods, are using that beeper as a callback technique. Dog can't hear you yell, they can't hear your whistle, or you don't want to sound like a human in the field. A beep will do that, or even a tone, a little bit more quiet there. The tone is, you know, a little bit lower key, if you will. Of course, whatever you're using those other buttons for, those other capabilities, you got to train for them just like you train for a verbal command or a whistle command or a hand signal. Then start overlaying those commands so that you're giving one in conjunction with the other for a while. Whatever you do with it, be safe out there and enjoy your collar's complete and total capabilities. Now, I am so excited about this aspect of our show today. I've been wanting to do this for a while. When I was in the radio business, I did it a lot. So, this is going to probably become a regular feature of the Upland Nation podcast. Stick around because the fun is just getting started. I am so looking forward to talking with you folks kind of sort of in person on this topic in particular, because it's a big one for me and for a lot of other people as well. So let's just get right to the phones. Rusty Witcher, are you on the phone with me there?
I am, Scott.
Welcome to the podcast, and tell me a little bit about yourself before we jump into the topic of discussion.
Okay, well, I am a small-town sports writer located about 30 miles north of Wichita. I write for my hometown newspaper. I've been hunting pheasants and quails since I was 11, and I got my hunter safety card in 1988. I've hunted a lot of private. I've hunted a lot of public. We try and get out as much as possible. I'm fortunate to have an editor who says, hey, go hurt yourself and write about it. So I get a lot of free time to spend in the field.
Oh, it reminds me of a reality show. Hey, good for you. Now the topic of the day, Rusty, is one that you can mm-hmm. relate to because you've had such perspective. And I mean that in the best possible way. Mm-hmm. We have challenges in our sport, everything from land use and management to access to cost, recruiting mm-hmm. new hunters. Well, what are your thoughts on that whole concept?
Scott, that's a great question because there's so many different facets to that. Like I said, we hunt a lot of public. We do a lot of walk-in hunting. Kansas is very fortunate with the walk-in program. I don't know if your listeners know a lot about that, but there's over 1 million acres of walk-in property enrolled in the program. Granted, some of that's good, some of that's bad. You really have to put some miles down to figure out what is good, what is bad. I think part of the challenge in that respect is sometimes, an example, a friend of mine and I just went and did a little scouting by Salina, the Salina area. And one of the fields that we looked at that is enrolled in walk-in was plowed with nothing on it. So I think there's some challenges in that respect of you never know quite what to expect in the walk-in program. I also think a factor in this that we have, which is is interesting, is some of the leasing, those big outfitter companies that are leasing ground up like nobody's business. And if you're not willing to pay the big bucks, a lot of it's for deer hunting, which, hey, cool, fine. I enjoy hearing stories of deer hunting. I don't deer hunt, but I think sometimes that takes away some opportunities, in fact, for upland hunting a little bit. An example I can give you there is there was a quarter section that we had hunted next to for years and years and years. And I oftentimes we found people coming across onto the ground that didn't have permission. And a lot of times you say, hey, you're not supposed to be over here. They say, hey, I'm sorry, you know, whatever. They went their separate ways. But part of that also becomes the fact that the landowner that owned that quarter section saw the dollar signs and said, hey, I'm going to go ahead and lease this out. So we lost access to that. So those are some of the challenges you see with the maintaining of the hunting and the ground, and the land.
And I see that, and I understand it because I use it too. And in fact, I'll be spending 5 days out in your country mm-hmm. doing exactly that on those walk-in hunting areas very soon. Mm-hmm. That's no different, really, in a lot of ways than back in the day when you knocked on doors and got permission. But what can we do about that if we want that walk-in hunting area, whatever we call it in whatever state, to at least meet a minimal level of quality? What do you think the state or we as consumers of that need to do?
I think the funding, it comes down to the funding issue. I'm not even sure what it comes down to in terms of what a landowner gets paid per acre. I don't think it's terribly much by the state to lease that. I wouldn't mind personally as a hunter seeing maybe an increase in license sales. The price of a license in Kansas for a resident isn't too terribly expensive. What's another $5 on top of that? That could go right back into the program to, hey, maintain these a little more or even lease more ground and have more state input into what is managed for hunting.
Yeah, yeah. We have, where I live in Oregon, we pay an extra $2 and it goes to mm-hmm. that. You know, the other thing, and I'll just leave it with this and got to get on to the next call, Rusty, but Montana has a program that basically pays per hunter visit. So if you got crappy mm-hmm. land or you plowed it all under before the season started, nobody comes over there and those farmers and ranchers don't get paid. Now that's a free market approach.
That is. And I wonder if they won't make a transition to doing something along those lines. Yeah. Now in Kansas, there's a couple of these walking areas that require you to have the iSportsman check in a lot, like they do with some of the public wetlands areas or some of those public areas. And that's starting to make a transition where it's free. You sign in with your phone and and they can kind of keep track of that. And I wonder if that's not a place they're going forward or moving towards.
Food for thought, some of the biggest challenges to our sport. There's all sorts of them out there. And I know Sean and some of Julie and Mark are all waiting to chime in on that. Mm-hmm. So Rusty, maybe I'll see you out there. I'm going to be in the same general area. Be safe and have a great season. All right, on the line with me now, Sean from somewhere in Oregon. That's about all I'd guess. Sean, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Scott. Honored to be here. I'm actually originally from Oregon, but currently living in Northern Virginia.
Okay, kept the phone. I guess we're all doing that these days, aren't we?
Oh, yeah.
All right. Well, from Oregon to the other side of the country, you're seeing a lot of, a lot of issues when it comes to the biggest challenges to our sport of hunting. And I use sport because I don't want to get too deep into the weeds on passion, lifestyle, and all that. But we all know that's what it is. Sean, in your estimation, what is the biggest challenge that we face these days?
You know, it's tough to pick out one. I think, hunting is kind of suffering a death of a thousand cuts. We got a lot of constraints on our time these days that we put on ourselves. But if you really have to boil it down, I think it really has to be recruitment of new hunters. There's a lot of studies out there. I think you've seen these as well about the dropping numbers in the hunters and anglers over the last, really, I think 2 decades, I think since the end of the 90s.
Sure.
Whether it's people aging out or people getting too busy with their lives or technology. It's just really tough to get new folks really out there and engaged.
You know, we used to joke about it almost, it was hard to take a kid away from there. At that point, it was just video games. Now it's anything you can hold in your hand. Have you tried anything? You have any suggestions on how we might fix this problem?
Certainly. Actually, I try to, me and I have a good group of friends I hunt and fish with. We try to make it our goal to introduce one person to the outdoors every season, whether it's hunting or fishing. We prefer hunting because it's always good to have that camaraderie in the duck blind or walking the upland fields. And we've had pretty good success with those folks that, whether they just hunt once or twice a year, and that they stick with it. They really enjoy that camaraderie. And if you're lucky, you know, a good meal that evening or some meat in the freezer. And I think some of that, we've seen this kind of culinary renaissance in wild game. There's a lot of great folks out there providing new recipes on their own, new culinary, or looking at some historical, cultural recipes. And I think that kind of helps carry that hunting pursuit through over year round.
So even new hunters march on their stomach, just like an army, I guess.
Exactly.
Have you come up with a single recipe that works for everybody? Because I'm still looking.
Well, you know, you can get really fancy or you can get, you know, really simple. You know, for instance, I have a 6-year-old son and my wife and I just had another son, our second last week. And so, I mean, for instance, a couple of weeks ago, I made my son pheasant nuggets and just real simple, red and fried or baked, be a little bit healthier. And then I made a duck leg soup just this past weekend, and my son loved it. He doesn't care what it is, as long as it's in front of him. He sees I enjoy it, he enjoys it as well.
Oh, that is fantastic. You're absolutely right. And, you know, something that's kind of relatable, like the nugget thing, that makes so much sense. And it's as easy as anything else to do out there. That's a great idea. Let's think more about things like that, everybody, as you're getting ready to take my call, if you will. We'll discuss all sorts of things in the biggest challenge arena. Food is one way to do it. Sean, great to talk with you, even though you're way over there and I'm still over here. Thanks for being on the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
Well, let's take a quick look at the Facebook page, because there are a lot of folks chiming in over there that haven't really been available by phone. Tom Kosmak talks about the grounds and how poorly we take care of some of those publicly accessible patches that we hunt. It's no wonder, he says, that driving around, you know, rutted roads, driving, leaving litter of all sorts, cleaning of birds, all those things also probably limit the number of folks who are willing to open their gates to us, whether they're being paid for them or not. And then Joel Conrad says, the marsh areas that have been tilled out and the loss of CRP, and we all know what that is all about, are big contributing factors to the demise, or the pending demise, or some of the challenges to our sport. I don't want to be a fatalist about all this. I still have a pretty strong opinion that we're probably going to be there in one way, shape, or form. But good points, both of them. Joel and Tom, thanks a bunch. Let's get back to the phones. All right, on the line with me now, Shane. Shane, welcome to the podcast. Where are you calling from?
I'm in Topeka, Kansas.
Know it well. One of my best friends, Ken Corbett, in Ravenwood Lodge out there. If you watch the TV show, you've probably seen Ravenwood a million times. I can't wait to get back. I'll be there in a few weeks. You know, we were talking about the challenges to our sport, and you were quite detailed in your Facebook responses there, and I thought I might get you to elaborate a little. If you had to rank these things as to their challenges and how we might work with them, what would you start with, Shane?
Well, I guess mine pertains to Kansas, but I'm sure it could spread to the same principle would apply to other states. I think that years ago, they went down the path of just chasing the immediate dollar, and deer hunting got out as the it thing to do here. And they started selling lots of permits for that, and pretty much they were not managing the deer herd, in my opinion. And what I noticed is that you had talked about the walk-in hunting program, at least again, in my opinion, it went down the toilet anywhere near a populated area like Wichita or Kansas City, where you got to the point where you'd have to drive like 2 to 3 hours to get into birds. And you used to be able to drive 45 minutes from Wichita, and there was lots of walk-in, and it all went away because it started getting leased.
Okay, so leasing again, somebody else locking up that property. What about the traffic itself? You talked about how you know, more and more people are just going to some of these places too. Is that a problem out there?
I think internet hotspotting creates some of it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, but as far as the traffic goes, I think also, as you read about other states deteriorating and not finding birds in Iowa, or maybe South Dakota had a down year, or Missouri not having anything, I'd see more and more out-of-state plates, which is great. I'm glad everyone is sharing the resource, but as other states are you know, not managing what they have or not putting an emphasis on upland bird habitat, it kind of concentrates everyone more in one place. Now, granted, in Kansas, you can go days and not see people, but still, I just, you know, couple that with the change in farming practices, it just doesn't make for a good recipe.
You mentioned internet hotspotting. Just for some of our listeners who may not be familiar with that term, why don't you describe that, and then we'll talk a little bit about it.
Just, you know, where guys will get on Facebook, or, you know, maybe a writer publishes an article and is pretty specific about an area, and especially if there's limited walk-in in a certain place, it really doesn't take long for people using their intelligence nowadays to figure out a spot, and then, you know, before you know it, no one's really there, and then you go there in a week or two, and then you can see all kinds of tire tracks and footprints, and, you know, people will just pound the snot out of one particular parcel, or, you know, the general ones in the area. That's mainly for the public. Obviously, private's probably not going to get that, but the farmers will get upset because they probably get more people knocking on their doors.
Oh, sure. If somebody says, here's the latitude and longitude, I'm sure that's an issue. But where do you draw the line on something like that? You know, here we are talking about the threats to our sport, including the fact that the number of bird hunters is dwindling by the year, and we all know that the ramifications of that are very dire. So how do we help people find a place to hunt? Whether it's your secret spot or something sort of less good but still encouraging enough, what do we do about that? Do we just be more general in our descriptions? Because I'm one of those guys. I write those articles too. So I try to be a little bit more generic about that. But what have you seen that might make sense?
I think being more generic, and then I've a couple of them groups I'm a member of, they've started, it looked like they were banning some of the posts where people were getting really specific, so I kind of like that. But I guess if you're going to go to the big picture, I think that the hunting interests need to get with the ag and then figure out the economics of the situation and figure out what works for the farmer, because I don't think that they've truly done that. I think that sometimes even the farmers are a little bit short-sighted, and they may chase the leasing dollar, whereas in my opinion, if they were to maybe farm for birds and the state were to put more of an emphasis on that, you can get more and more people that can come share that resource. Whereas if you're focusing only on big game, you can't run as many people through, and not as many people are going to visit. So it could help your small town, could help keep the small town business alive. Because yeah, I've seen, I don't even know how many places in Kansas where the cafes are closing. It's not only because it's not due to the ag industry. I think a lot of it's because there's no tourism there anymore, and most of it was hunting before.
Oh, yeah, and that's not the only state. I've seen that in a half dozen towns in South Dakota in the last couple of years. So it's a universal problem, and your solution, again, it comes back around to incentives and market-based approaches that I'm really liking. Good idea on all of those. I'll turn you loose so you can get back to your chores. I know it's later over there than it is here. So good to talk with you, Shane. Thanks for contributing to the podcast.
Thank you.
Mark Cross made a comment on Facebook that I think is probably more true than we all would like to admit, and that is that all hunters and outdoorsmen just don't get along. All people want to do is fight for whatever they do and leave the rest in the dust. Boy, oh boy, isn't that the truth? I remember many, many years ago sitting in a meeting where the PETA folks had proposed a ballot measure to ban certain aspects of hound hunting. Let's just leave it at that for now. In the room were virtually representatives from virtually every group I've ever seen in the sporting world. But the fly fishers were mad at the bow hunters, and the compound bow guys didn't like the old-timey stick and string guys, and the houndsmen had problems with the bird dog guys, and so on and so forth. I was reminded again of Ben Franklin's saying that if we don't all hang together, we will assuredly hang separately. All right, our next caller is Scott. He's on the line with us right now. Scott, welcome to the podcast.
It's a pleasure, Scott.
It's a pleasure speaking to another Scott. You must be a pretty smart guy with a name like that.
I mean, it's a big club, but we're all pretty good. So,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah. You're probably thinner and younger than me, but that's okay because I got cunning and wiles. So that'll be my claim to fame long before you can make the same claim. You know, we're talking here about the threats to our sport, our lifestyle, our passion, whatever you want to call it. What do you love to do out there first? Tell me all about it, and then we'll get into what we need to do next about all that.
Well, yeah, so I'm a rough grouse hunter by trade, if you would, originally from northern Minnesota, and I actually live up in Alaska right now, currently. But spent a couple of years actually traveling around the country, upland bird hunting and doing some waterfowl hunting along the way.
Mm-hmm.
And as such, I've, you know, been out with a lot of different hunters from a lot of different backgrounds, and I've made a lot of friends and connections, and have some personal friends who have kind of gotten into the sport more so via me and kind of my passion for it. So basically now up in Alaska, I do a lot of grouse hunting still, do a lot of ptarmigan hunting, and, you know, Alaska's got a lot of places to do a lot of stuff. So,
well, you mentioned, you know, kind of recruiting in the broadest sense of the term. I mean, is that one of the challenges we face, or is something else just slapping you upside the head as more of a priority?
You know, that's something that obviously gets talked about a lot in circles. And I personally, I think, you know, the two things we always hear is recruitment and access, right? You know, like, we can't get enough people out, and then likewise, we don't have enough space or places to get them out to. Personally, my experience has been that the access is, although an issue, it's maybe not a preventative issue.
Mm-hmm.
Usually there's space of some kind to get out and hunt wherever you are. It might not be enough of it or as much as we would like, but there is space somewhere. I would say recruitment, and definitely kind of, I would say, the mentoring end of recruiting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's real easy. There's lots of events out there to get somebody out for a day, get them out for a mentored hunt, or, you know, all that kind of stuff. But I think the lost piece of that is kind of the follow-up of keeping them out, right? Like, you get somebody out on one grouse hunt, let's say, well, we need to get those people out on like six grouse hunts.
Amen. You are absolutely right. I'm glad you bring that up. It's, you know, it's one thing to show people how fun it is. It's another thing to make it easy for them to carry on and keep doing it and keep doing it and keep doing it. Have you done anything like that in the past?
Well, I would say almost currently. So I've got a couple of friends up here in Alaska who, they found upland hunting kind of on their own, but we have some mutual friends up here, and they were kind of actively looking for a mentor and some help, if you would. And actually have since, they got two young German Shorthairs over the winter. So I've been helping them with not just the hunting element, but the dog training element of it as well.
Nice.
And it's a lot of work, but it's the fun kind of work, right?
Yeah, well, I know from personal experience, I started my own little training group this summer for the first time, and boy, do I feel good about that, because I've seen the results, and I would suggest everybody out there who has a little tiny bit of knowledge can share all that with somebody else who has even less. What is the biggest challenge with you when it comes to that aspect of things? Because I know it's organizational with me, finding a night that works and that sort of thing. Got any tips for us?
Specifically with dog training? What I've been preaching with my friends is not trying to turn everything into like a giant process, right? Like, you get a lot more, and your dog gets a lot more for that matter, I think, especially with young dogs, training a lot in small intervals, right?
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
You know, and especially with them with short hairs, they live conveniently where they can go for a walk, and there's, you know, like, pigeons in the park and some ducks in the pond, and I'm like, hey, if your dog wants to point at a mallard that's swimming by, like, let it do it. Right? You know, like, you use the tools and the time you have, and, you know, kind of set those thresholds for success, where you can achieve them and at levels you can get to, right? Like, you don't need your 8-month-old puppy to go out in the field on the first day and hold its first 5 rough grouse points like rock solid, right? Yeah. Like, it's gonna just accept the fact that it's gonna run around and chew on sticks and bump birds and do all that stuff, and just kind of let it succeed as you can get it through those steps.
Boy, you sound like me every Thursday night all summer. Oh, that's great, and good on you for that. How about the habitat side of things? Are you seeing anything, maybe not in Alaska as much, but, you know, maybe in the upper Midwest where you were? Is that still as big an issue as it is out here in the West?
Like, as far as access to it, or like, yeah, the condition, yeah, of it?
Well, we're going to talk about the condition of it a lot in the next few weeks, believe me. So, yeah. So do you have, did you have adequate access to land out there, whether it's private or public or walk-in or whatever?
Oh, absolutely. So where I'm from in northern Minnesota, there's a lot of national forest and state forest land. And, you know, essentially, I think the hardest element, especially for like a new hunter there, is recognizing, I think, you know, the resources of finding what land you can hunt on and how much of it there is pretty easy. Mm-hmm. And kind of like I said, there's, if you look, you don't have to look too hard to find it.
There's an app for that.
There is. And it's a pretty good app for that. Those guys do a really good job with that.
Yeah.
And you know, what I would tell someone is it's easy to look at acreage numbers and, you know, how far and all that kind of stuff from afar. But when you look at like, so up in northern Minnesota, and I'd say northern Wisconsin has a kind of a similar situation, and the UP of Michigan is really well known for it. You know, it's easy to say like, oh, well, there's only this national forest. Well, there might be millions and millions of acres in that national forest. And I'm pretty sure it's going to take you a long time to hunt all of it if you ever could. You know?
Well, there you go again, managing expectations.
Yeah, so when you say something like, wow, this state only has X amount of public land, well, it's like, well, that amount might be a lot more than it sounds when you really get out there and try to, like, actively hunt it.
Especially if your boots are too tight.
Yeah, right.
Well, good points, all of them, and I appreciate your thoughts on that. I'll turn you loose to whatever time it is in Alaska these days. Thanks for contributing to the Upland Nation podcast.
Absolutely, man. Thanks for having me.
You bet. And another great comment from Brad Heron on the Facebook page: time commitment and dedication to even get started. I think that's kind of a segue from what we just had on our phone call. It's one thing to say, yeah, I want to do this. And it's another thing to say, when are we going? Let alone, when are we going again? So remember that if you're doing some mentoring of one sort or another. And remember that, you know, it's not for everybody. So don't obsess over it. So we're talking about all the threats, and we'll narrow it down in future podcasts as well. But on the line with me right now from, I'm going to say Texas based on that area code. Jim, what are your thoughts on the threats to sports, outdoor sports in general, but in particular bird hunting and hunting?
Well, I mean, the biggest threat is the liberal press and the views on sporting, hunting and gun control. I mean, it's just a whole myriad of issues that affect upland hunting or all hunting. And then you get with agricultural practices, you know, the farmers want to plow from fence row to fence row. I was born and raised in Illinois, and we used to have pheasants, mm-hmm, and Hungarian partridge when I was a kid, and in McHenry County. And now there are no pheasants, and Hungarian partridge have been gone for years and years and years. So you know, there's just it's just a whole bunch of problems.
Well, you bring up one that in another life I was involved in to a great degree, and that is public image of the hunting community and how it's being portrayed not only by the news media per se, but also how it's being viewed by the consumers of the news media. Are we to blame for some of that?
Probably because we're too passive. You know, the true sportsman is not the problem, other than we're too passive. We don't express our love. You know, it's not, for me, hunting is not how many birds I shoot. It's my relationship with my bird dogs and the relationship being outside and the whole thing, camaraderie with friends. So the public thinks we're just murderers. We just go out and slaughter game because we like to kill things, and that's not what we do. And I don't know how to get that message across.
How about if somebody makes a great TV show about that kind of stuff?
That would be wonderful. You know, and then get them to watch it.
Yeah, well, that's another challenge, believe me.
Get them to watch it. You know, when I was a child growing up in Northern Illinois, and I live in Texas now, I got my first shotgun when I was 8 years old. My dad trusted me to go out hunting on my own when I was 11. So, you know, I would go hunting every day before school, before I got on the bus to go to middle school. There was an elementary school right behind my house, and I had to walk through that elementary school early in the morning with my Weimaraner at the time and a 20-gauge shotgun and hunt in the fields behind it. I came back through the elementary school when they were buses were arriving, teachers were arriving, put my shotgun away, put my dog back in her kennel, and got on the bus, which was, they stopped right behind my house.
And nobody freaked out. Nobody thought that was so bad.
That's right.
So what has changed, Jim? I mean,
you know, it's a societal problem. It starts with the violence. It starts with the music. You know, I was a child of the 60s, and it was all about love. And now it's all about killing. So.
Well, some people would say if you remember the 60s, you weren't really there.
Yeah, really.
But so what we need to do is wear more tie-dyed shirts and listen to sitar music or something.
That's right. You know,
which I have no problem with. Hey.
Yeah, that's right.
My sister used to date some of the Grateful Dead, so we get it. All right. Well, you know, the public image thing, we haven't discussed that at length on this podcast, but boy, I'll tell you, that's going to be on another podcast in and of itself, because it is something for us to be more mindful of. And that could be everything from how we portray ourselves and our hunting success in social media to getting on those guys. And I remember doing this more and more often in the last few months, who portray us inaccurately in the news media. So good points, all of them, Jim. Thank you for being on the Upland Nation podcast.
You're welcome.
Boy, and on that note, you know, we could go on forever on this thing, and we will in little bits and pieces, so don't panic. Believe me, we won't cover it all in one fell swoop, but this is something that is important to us in any number of ways, whether it's just for yourself and your own motives, or for the future of our sport, the future of the habitat, our children, our grandchildren, everybody else. So stick around for more of that kind of talk here on the Upland Nation podcast. Good job, everybody. Thanks for participating. Let's do it again sometime real soon. Lots more coming up, including our Upland Nation trivia quiz and a prize. But in the meanwhile, let's talk a little bit more about that Dogtra TNB dual training collar that I mentioned earlier. Free shipping and 10% off. All you got to do is check out with the code SLUN10 at Dogtra.com. If you're not doing it yet, you probably ought to consider using two collars on one dog for steadiness, plus all the other obedience questions, including the force fetching process. I'm doing it with Flick, and it seems to pay off every day in one way or another. He delivered his first pheasant from across the water today. And in large part, I attribute that to the ability to do both at once with two collars, one on the flank, one on the neck. Learn more at dogtra.com and don't forget free shipping and 10% off with the code SLUN10. Speaking of discount codes, make a note of this one. TagSafari.com will give you 15% off their handmade, hand-created in every way apparel. Just go to TagSafari.com, and when you check out, use the code TAGLINDEN15. Free shipping all the time as well at TagSafari.com. These guys may be new to you. They've been in the big game and the safari world for a long, long time. But when they started making upland apparel, including a couple nice, what I'll call classically designed hunting vests, adding some blaze orange to some of their gear, they came to me and said, "We want you to tell the world." Well, I'll tell you. You got to learn the backstory on these guys and how they are helping the local economy in so many other countries by sourcing, manufacturing, and then even packaging their stuff in products and materials right there on the ground in Africa and other countries now. Learn more at TagSafari.com and don't forget to tell them I sent you. Finally, thank you again, Dogtra T&B Dual. If you want more information on them, go to dogtra.com. Free shipping and 10% off. SLUN10 is the code. Okay, let's jump right in and talk about our upland trivia question. The prize this week is one of my own designs. It's a Jaeger lead, you know, over-the-shoulder lead. It's in camo, so we call it the Waterfowler lead. It's got a slip lead, like a choke chain, if you will, on the end. That's the part the dog's head goes through. Pretty handy. Speaking of which, it keeps your hands free. If you have the answer to this question, send it to me by email at scottlindenoutdoors@gmail.com. All right, here you go. In what Canadian province was the duck tolling retriever developed? You know the answer. Send it to scottlindenoutdoors@gmail.com. Good luck to you. Thank you for listening. Tell your friends. Check the Upland Nation Facebook page. Please subscribe and leave us a review however you get your podcasts. I'll see you at uplandnation.com and at our Facebook page. Thanks again for listening. I'm Scott Linden. Be safe out there. See you in the field.